The panel's called Anti-Americanism Fashioning the Conservative Response. I think we risk disappointment when we imagine that an anti-intellectual phenomenon can be rectified through an intellectual response. And this is the conceit of intellectuals, to always and everywhere think that there's nothing that a good argument can't solve. But the power of persuasion, I think, is simply not very persuasive here, at least when it comes to domestic anti-Americanism. It's hard for people to see anti-intellectualism when it's embraced by intellectuals. That's a problem with anti-Americanism. If it were embraced by people with names like Bubba and Bobby Liu, you know, we'd all be able to see it as the know-nothing movement that it is. But because its exponents are people like Gore Vidal and Susan Sarandon, we imagine anti-Americanism occupying a higher plane than say, jingoism. But really, they're just two sides of the same coin, just unthinking, reflexive. Take for example a guy like Noam Chomsky, who may have a higher IQ than everyone in this room, but my suspicion is he's probably been wrong more than anyone in this room. You know? And if you don't know Noam Chomsky, think of Michael Moore with his brain on steroids, or his body on a diet. In the 1970s, Chomsky rather infamously wrote a book review in The Nation magazine where he claimed that the genocide then taking place in Pol Pot's Cambodia was U.S. propaganda. It wasn't going on. And to the extent that there were any killings in Cambodia, it was the U.S.'s fault. In the 80s, Chomsky claimed that the standard of living in Cuba was actually the same or better than the standard of living in the United States. And he said, what we need in America is not so much dissent, but denazification. And just last year, in response to the assassination of Osama bin Laden, Chomsky wrote an article claiming that bin Laden, he called him a victim, he called him a suspect, never called him a terrorist. He claimed that he didn't buy into the idea that bin Laden was behind 9/11, and that, of course, he compared George W. Bush to Hitler, which was something that was like obligatory in the last decade. Chomsky's is a reflexive, non-thinking, programmed anti-Americanism. No matter the geopolitical event, the villain is always America. Anti-Americanism usually manifests itself in this way, as a tic. And when you see someone with a tic, you don't respond. You might look away, or you certainly don't respond. You don't try to persuade the man who's suffering from a tic to stop indulging his tic. You don't debate him about why he's wrong to have the tic. In fact, there's something far more wrong with you than the man with the tic if you go around trying to convince him to stop having his tic. Just let it be. I wrote a thick book a few years back called A Conservative History of the American Left. And when I wrote that book, I was able to interview a number of the leading figures on the left over the course of the last half century or so. And I asked, there was one question that I asked all of these leaders, you know, and the question was basically, what's the animating principle behind the left? What does a leftist believe? And I got all sorts of answers. Some of them were contradictory. Some of them were things that probably you believe. Some of them were incoherent. There was really only one that stood out, and it was from a guy named Al Haber. And Al Haber is a forgotten individual now, but he in the late 1950s, he took a dead organization, the Student League for Industrial Democracy, and he turned it into a very lively organization, the Students for a Democratic Society. He was essentially the founder of SDS. And Al Haber still lives in Ann Arbor, Michigan, in a modest home filled with books. And when I caught up with him, he was stuffing a mailing late into the night. And I asked him, what is it that a leftist believes? And his answer was, what is the better world that's possible? It's very different from what, you know, most conservatives would believe. I mean, when I think about things, I always think about how they can get worse, you know? And I imagine there's people in the audience that have the same view. But yet he thinks, what's the better world possible? And on the surface, that seems to be a rather optimistic way of looking at the world. But really, if you look at America and you're always saying, what's the better America possible, you're setting yourself up for a lifetime of disappointment and letdown. And I think that partly explains the very negative view that American leftists have for their country. If you compare anything to an ideal, it's always going to fall short. Nothing ever lives up to the ideal. And so rather than compare America to an ideal, you know, perhaps a healthier way of looking at at America would be to compare America to places that actually exist in the world. I mean, think right now. There's a big discussion about a war on women, metaphorical war on women that the Republicans are apparently perpetrating. There are places in the world where there's actually a war on women. We heard about it last night. Just last month, the leading human rights group in Pakistan came out with a study documenting 943 instances of honor killings in Pakistan last year. And in almost every instance, there wasn't even a pretense of an investigation. There is a war on women in the world, and there are actually casualties. This is happening. Prisoners' rights is a big hobby horse for a lot of folks on the left. Angela Davis has made it a crusade. I wonder why, thinking of her biography. But you know, it's usually used as sort of a brickbat upon which to beat the United States. And I'm sure a lot of you are probably saying prisoners' rights. Isn't that why they go to prison to have, you know, to have their rights taken away? But obviously, you know, nevertheless, prisoners maintain some rights. A couple months back, you may have missed it because it wasn't widely covered. There was a prison fire in Honduras where you had over 350 inmates just immolated, you know, dead, because of the horrid prison conditions that they have there. But because that doesn't serve an agenda, it doesn't serve sort of the anti-American agenda, the people who are all up in arms about prisoners' rights, they're not talking about that. The big story over the course of the last month has been this tragedy, a 17-year-old boy murdered, I'm not remember, killed by a, I don't know, neighborhood paladin, you know, neighborhood watch guy in a gated community in Florida. And for Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton, this proves American racism. But if we avert our gaze from Central Florida and we look at, say, like South Sudan, where every week or so in the New York Times there is a story about a dozen people here, 100 people there, getting killed because they belong to the wrong tribe. And then the next week, the people with the other tribe getting killed. What's going on in South Sudan, that's, you know, some pretty heavy stuff. I mean, what's happening in America is certainly not healthy. There's a lot of racial antagonism that's been stoked. But when you compare it to what's actually going on in the world, it's minor stuff in comparison. There are... And so what I would suggest to the left is sort of to practice what they preach with regard to multiculturalism. Don't just fixate. You know, don't be the man with the muckrake and always looking down and you know, looking at America in such a negative way. But don't fixate in America. Look at the world. Look what's actually going on. And if you do study other cultures, we start to look rather exemplary in comparison. There are cultural markers that certainly separate America, not just from the third world, but from the rest of the West. And these are things like a tradition of free enterprise, you know, belief in God, religion. I think when they do the surveys every few years, the Pew does it. The church going in attendance in the United States is more so than any other industrialized nation, except I think Poland and Ireland. So that's a cultural marker. I had a German friend who came to America, and she was struck by how many flags we hung up. She thought we were a bunch of Nazis having flags everywhere. And that's something that would strike foreigners as odd, the patriotism. These cultural markers provide a logical reason why those on the left would display an illogical anti-American tick. So the folks on the American left, they perform a really delicate balancing act. They can... You know, either be purist left-wingers, and if they're pure, they will alienate the American people because those cultural markers are things that offend leftists. Or they can be pragmatic and embrace some of those cultural markers, and they risk alienating the purists. And when I wrote this book, Conservative History of the American Left, I was struck by one of the characters, a guy by the name of J.A. Weyland, who was the publisher of a periodical weekly called Appeal to Reason. And Appeal to Reason really was, I think, the most successful publication in the history of the American left. About 100 years ago, they had over a million subscribers. And they were successful because they embraced America. It was published not from Boston or Washington, D.C. It was published from Girard, Kansas. And right in the middle of middle America. Wayland was a socialist who could have taught any capitalist a thing about capitalism. He could have taught any capitalist how to run a business. And when you read Appeal to Reason, the way they stylized socialism was that it was a political version of Christianity, that Jesus Christ was the first socialist. And you could see how in a country like America, that would be a lot more appealing than saying, you know, religion is the opiate of the masses or something like that. That's not going to get you anywhere here. Wayland had enormous success. If you contrast Wayland to, say, the various incarnations of the Communist Party or the Weathermen, these are people that through most of the history of their organizations, were at war on America. The only time that I think, the Communist Party, the one time when it had a measurable degree of popularity in the 1930s was when its slogan was "Communism is 20th century Americanism." But when these institutions were so anti-American that they wanted to not only take away our democratic form of government, but install foreign overlords over us, however ridiculous that sounds, they didn't just repulse conservatives; they repulsed other people on the American left. So, an American left that defines itself by hostility to religion, patriotism, the family, free enterprise, that American left can never truly be American. And an American left that embraces religion, patriotism, the family, and free enterprise, that American left can never truly be left. So they have a dilemma. One would think that living in America would be an antidote to domestic anti-Americanism. You think about the airplane and the computer and the internet and the iPod and all these great inventions, the CAT scan, Jonas Salk inventing a vaccine for polio. If that's not going to convince you that anti-Americanism is foolish, then I don't know that there's any words that I can say that would convince someone like that. I mean, if the experience of living in America doesn't convince you, then all of the talk in the world isn't going to bring you over either. The pull of ideology is even greater than the pull of reality, at least in this instance. Let me close with a quote from a guy who I think in this room is a lot more like than Michael Moore and Noam Chomsky and some of these people I've been talking about. Edmund Burke said, "To make us love our country ought to be lovely." And I would submit to you that most Americans love America not merely because it's our country, although that's a good reason of loving America, but we love America because it's lovely. Thank you so much.
And now in the coveted spot of cleanup hitter, Grover Norquist.
Good. Well, in response to the question, what is to be done, I think the answer is given to us by a title of a book James Fallows wrote where he was relating a discussion where Americans were wondering, what should we do in the 80s in response to the Japanese challenge, their economic success? What part of Japan should we emulate? And Fallows, and one of the people there said, no, we should be more like us. The answer is we should be more like us. Now, how do we get there? How do we accomplish that if we're trying to defend liberty and freedom and be a beacon of same? How do we get to do that? Bertolt Brecht in 53... when the East Germans put down a workers' revolt over there, which is kind of embarrassing since they're supposed to be representing the workers, rather brutally commented that what the East Germans should do is elect a new people. And I want to suggest that that's what we can do. We can create a new electorate, a new people. The left has a whole cottage industry explaining the demographics are on their side. They say, take a look at how many African Americans there are and how many Hispanics there are now and how many turn 21 in X number of years, and they count all women on their team, and they take this demographic trend and they say, see, in 10, 20, or 30 years, we win. And that follows their politics, follows their demographic theory of how they're going to change the country. They try and divide people on racial lines, on income lines, on gender lines, on ethnicity, in order to then drive the case that, see, as you get more of X, Y, and Z, we win. And I want to argue that what we really need to look at are those vote-moving issues that individuals and families vote on and how we can create more of us in the electorate. And some examples that are things that are not hypotheticals, but things that are actually going on. 20 years ago, in all 50 states, homeschooling was largely illegal. Today, it's largely legal in 50 states. There are 1.5 million parents presently homeschooling, 2.5 million kids being homeschooled. If you go back, there are now 10 million adults who were homeschooled, and 4 million parents who have homeschooled. Those are different voters and different people than parents who send their kids to the government school to be babysat for 12 years. It becomes a central part of their life, and it changes how they vote. Talk to a homeschooler. They are much more radical individualists and self-assured and self-confident, and they run their own lives. And the polling data on the people who were homeschooled is very healthy for the modern Republican Party. The school choice movement of allowing people to go to private schools, not just homeschooling, but private schools, is finally, we always knew that if we could sort of break through and get one state to really move this forward, that it would be unstoppable. We now have 11 states with significant school choice voucher tax credits for scholarship programs, but we just had Indiana pass a law that will, over the next 3 years, allow half of the students in Indiana vouchers. Louisiana just passed a law which also will move to half the students. We're talking about 1 million students now. It'll be difficult the next time we go to the ballot in California or Michigan for the other team to explain that school choice means witches schools and all these other things that they explained would happen, because there'll be that many examples. But a parent who controls where they send their kid to school, a parent who's decided the government school's not where they want, a private school is what they want, a teacher who teaches at a private school is a different person and a different voter than somebody who belongs to the teachers union, has a government worker's pension, and a government worker's attitude towards life. The concealed carry movement in the United States. Again, 30 years ago, Vermont was the only state where you had the right, by virtue of just being a citizen, to carry a gun concealed. Now, in over 40 states, we have shall-issue concealed carry laws, where you walk in, you're not a criminal, you're not insane, you can shoot a gun, and you pay $100. You can have a concealed carry permit. 7 million Americans carry concealed today with permits. Now, add to that that other states had said, we want what Vermont has, okay? We want to be able to just have a concealed carry because we say so. And the challenge was that when you pass that law, Vermonters can't carry their gun across the border into New Hampshire. They don't have a concealed carry permit there. So the new standard for concealed carry laws are Arizona, Wyoming, Alaska, which says in-state you don't need a permit to carry concealed. But if you want a concealed carry permit so you can drive across the country with other states that recognize the concealed carry permit of Alaska and Arizona and Wyoming, you can. Again, the Second Amendment, people who care about liberty, people who care about the Second Amendment, there was a secular decline happening, largely because every generation, about 25% of hunters have been declining in terms of the number of hunters. Not deer hunters. Deer hunters are doing fine. The foo-foo bird hunters are what's been declining. And the challenge is that with hunters, yes, they care about the Second Amendment vaguely because every year for a couple weekends they go out and irritate Bambi's relatives. But that's a different level of commitment to the Second Amendment than 7 million people carrying a gun in the small of their back. You'll never take their Second Amendment rights away. You have changed the nature of the people who carry concealed. 7 million. We see the same thing going on with labor unions. We've seen the secular decline in labor unions, largely by not changing the laws to force people into unions, to the point where about 11-12% of the working population are in unions, 7% of the private sector, 35% of government workers are unionized. We're all familiar with what Wisconsin did. Wisconsin passed a law which, among other things, said the state and local governments will no longer withhold your union dues. Now, you're a member of the teachers union. You can belong to the teachers union. Nobody says you can't. But we're not withholding for a teacher who makes $50,000 a year in salary in Wisconsin, $1,000 dues. Okay? When it came out of your paycheck, collected by the local government and given to the teachers union in Wisconsin, your hostility was not to the union for that $1,000. You never even saw that $1,000. The teachers' union representative came and told you cheerful things about what they were doing for you. Today in Wisconsin, when the union leadership comes to talk to you, they want your $1,000. They're not your friends. And so this changes the nature of the relationship. The changes in teacher tenure. Idaho, no teacher tenure. Florida, no teacher tenure. They changed the rules in Louisiana, so they still call it teacher tenure, but half of teachers don't have it. So, you know, the less quality teachers don't have it, and if you ever screw up and fall down into the lower half, you don't have it for another 5 years. They might as well not have teacher tenure because it doesn't protect people who aren't doing their jobs. The teachers who operate as teachers without tenure are different people than people who have tenure, K through 12. It changes the nature of the voters. Demographics can change, and it's not just all racial or gender or income. We're talking about the demographics of vote-moving issues. Now, government workers, great polling data done by Scott Rasmussen. In general, if you're a government worker, you're 10% more Democrat. Hold the job for 20 years, you're 30% more Democrat. Get paid more than $75,000 a year, you're 30% more Democrat. So having your kid work at the school, at the town pool, will not ruin him or scar him for life. But once you've worked for the government long enough, it begins to change the nature of who you are. Because among other things, at some point you look out and say, if I was ever to go back out into the private sector, nobody pays what they pay here. Nobody has a pension like they do here, and they expect you to work. So, again, this changes the nature of the electorate, which is why the solution, every Democrat solution we've heard over the last 30 years, 100,000 more teachers, 100,000 more cops, they always want 100,000 more government workers because they know they do well off the top there. Now, the counterpart to that is the emerging investor class. And again, Scott Rasmussen's done some great polling. If you have $5,000 worth of stock in a 401k, an IRA, a flexible savings account, all these various ways of saving $5,000 or more, it makes you, on average, 18% more Republican than Democrat. Okay, that's true for all demographics. Poor people who own stock are more Republican. Rich people who own stock are more Republican. Men, women, private government workers, private sector workers. It moves everybody in the right direction with one exception, and that is women who earn more than $75,000 a year, who are already fairly Republican, but $5,000 worth of stock does not move them in the right direction. So if you know any women like that, don't give them any stock. It does absolutely no good. However, if you buy them a gun, and unless it's one of the really nice 50 caliber guns, it's less than the $5,000. Immigration. There's a reason why the left has fought very hard against H-1B visas, bringing all sorts of talented, wealthy people, entrepreneurs into the United States because they would become Republicans. So there are a whole series of ways that one can challenge the small business community. Small business men and women. If you went person to person during the Tea Party rallies, the thing that I noticed with these people were self-employed. Over and over, non-politicized, self-employed people who are terrified. Now, again, the left is not stupid. They're evil. And they understand that small business, independent professionals, independent contractors, self-employed people don't need anything from the government. You can, if you're the mayor of Chicago, what do you do for somebody like this? How do you get them to feel that they owe you and be on your team? And therefore, almost everything, I mean, it's all this war on women nonsense. If you want a consistent theme of what everything the Obama administration's done, it's been to destroy the small business community, the small entrepreneur. They've got along fine with General Electric and General Motors, okay? That's not the challenge. They're even willing to reduce their marginal tax rates. But one thing to keep in mind is since the Reagan tax reform, almost all small businesses and many larger businesses pay individual taxes. So they pay the 35% individual rate, which Obama wants to take the corporate 35 down to, he says, he doesn't really, but he's willing to talk about it, wants to take it down to 28%. But he's committed, and it's in writing and baked into the cake, he wants to take the tax on small businesses up to 45%. This is on purpose, comrade. This is deliberate in order to squelch the small business community. Everything that we can do to make it easier for people to become self-employed, independent contractors. I mean, look, we win the day that we pass a law. There's an independent contractor set of rules. If you want to be an independent contractor rather than an employee, you have to jump through a set of hoops. Republicans for years said, let's not have the 14 or 17 point rule, let's have only a 7 or a 3 rule about what would let somebody be an independent contractor. I want, and I believe that we will accomplish getting to, there's one rule step. Do you want to be an independent contractor? All you have to say is, I wish to be an independent contractor. If the employer, the business, and the worker agree that the worker will be an independent contractor, that's the end of the conversation. What have we just done? We've made all labor law voluntary in this country. Okay? And all of a sudden, organized labor is nowhere, and you have not tens of millions of self-employed people, but 100-plus million self-employed people in the country. Again, the pension reform movement that you're seeing, for instance, in Utah, builds into the observation that Rasmussen put forward. Utah passed a law, state of Utah, state senator Lilienquist, I'm mangling the last name, wrote and got passed a law starting July 1st of last year. All government employees hired in the state of Utah, teachers, cops, firemen, local government people, state legislators, will have a 401k pension. Here is your pay for the year. Here's 10% of your pay for your 401k. We're now done. Okay? Stick around as long as you want. When you walk out the door, you walk out with your 401k. We will not find out in 20 or 30 years, oh, surprise, we haven't been stealing enough money from the people of Utah to pay your pension, or surprise taxpayers, you've now got, we're going to have to take more of your money to pay these commitments. There will be no additional unfunded liabilities created in the pension system in Utah as a result of this law. It's 10% for all government workers except cops and firemen to get 12% because they retire earlier. That law will likely be passed in Wyoming and North Dakota soon. It's the target for Louisiana. Of the 24 states with Republican House, Senate, and governor, it remains on the table as an option for all of those states. Watch for this. Again, you're taking government workers and making them shareholders and changing the nature, because at some point when they hit 52, their pension savings are a much bigger part of their life than their pay increase for next year or the year after that or the year after that. We cannot change human nature, but we can change the circumstances that individuals find and turn them into advocates for liberty rather than enemies of liberty. And again, school choice does the same thing. And with one observation, that is that the personal is political. Conservatives have more children than liberals. I actually did a study of this. I went through the state legislative Facebooks, okay, because they tell you how many kids they have. And the Republican state legislators have 2 or 3 times as many kids as the Democratic state legislators. My favorite witty comeback was the Arizona leader of the Arizona Traditional Values organization who used to go and debate a friend of his who was from some ACLU liberal, and he would end the debate by saying, this has been a fun debate and my 5 children will outvote your 1. So I would argue that what can we do? When we go to reform government, when we talk about what is our list of things to do, keep in mind that good policy also breeds more self-confident individuals who are more in control of their own lives, who aren't asking the state to go pick the pockets of their neighbors. Again, A homeschooler with a 401k and a concealed carry permit does not need the goddamn government for anything. And we can, not everybody needs to live on a farm to be capable of this kind of independence. We can do it in cities and across the country in suburbs, and I would suggest that not only can we do this, but if you look at the Ryan Plan is how to begin the process for federal legislation. State legislation, watch Walker, watch Bobby Jindal. This, we're moving in the right direction. State, for crying out loud, look at Maine. We're moving in the right direction in many, many states, and at the national level, Bobby Jindal's efforts to move defined benefit pensions to defined contribution and block granting all of the welfare programs are moving in that direction. We can create more of us and fewer of them without gallows. Thank you.
Thank you all. Weren't those great presentations? And now we have about 40 minutes for discussion, question and answer. As you approach the microphone, and there's obviously a long line of takers, I would just ask you to please identify yourself, direct your question to the panelist or panelists you'd like to respond, and try to be brief in deference to your colleagues because we'd like to give everybody a chance to participate. Lee, you're first.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Lee Edwards, and the hat I'm going to wear here is chairman of the Victims of Communism Memorial Foundation. And we've talked a lot about communism at this conference, and because we're talking about what is to be done, I'd like all of you to be invited and to attend on June 12th in Washington, D.C., the fifth anniversary of the Victims of Communism Memorial. The fifth anniversary, and we will have speeches, we will have music, we will have people from all over the world talking about what happened to their countries under communism. Some 20 ambassadors will lay wreaths at the memorial for the victims in their particular countries. This is not just a look at the past, but a look at the present. Because there are some five countries now which are still under communist regimes. That's something we often forget. China, North Korea, Vietnam, Laos, little Laos, and Cuba. And so we invite you all to come to that. Secondly, we will also, at that occasion, unveil for the first time the online Gulag exhibit. This is something we've been working on for a year. It will enable you to make a virtual visit to a gulag, to a barracks, to a compound, and to see what it was like to be in a gulag exhibit and a gulag camp, forced labor camp. Finally, we will also be unveiling at that time a curriculum on communism, and we're looking to make sure that our homeschooling friends and also public schools and private schools are able to use this 10-lesson curriculum on communism for high schools. That's being vetted right now with teachers. We think it'll make a difference and make people understand that there were 100 million victims of communism, and unhappily and tragically, there are still too many victims of communism in places like the Laogai in China, and also what's happening in that hermit kingdom of North Korea. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thanks, Lee. Bill.
My name is Bill Carruth with the Liberty Institute in Dallas. I've really enjoyed this meeting more than some of the others, perhaps because we have some low-hanging fruit that I can understand better than some of the esoterica that we occasionally get into. And one of the things that has seemed to come up again and again is that most of the people, whoever that is, the general population still likes America. As you say, we like you, we want to go home with you. The idea of opening the gates, which way do they run? They run towards us. And then the people who don't like us are the elite, and I would define that as those who are in government or want to be in government. Another way of saying that is those who would like to run our lives for us versus those who would like to let us run our own lives. And then we look at why they would hate America, and that is because America is different from the rest of the world. The rest of the world has always had kings, emperors, shahs, somebody to run their life and run the whole country, versus America, which said, no, we'd rather do it ourselves. Thank you. So they hate us. That's a simple reason, because we appreciate individual freedom, and they don't. They being the leaders, the elite who would want to run everybody else's life. And then in that, I would include Americans. Our leadership exhibits the same fundamental characteristics. They want to run our lives. They don't like America. So if we're trying to say we want to be lessen the hatred of America, I'm not sure I agree with that. If America is hated because of what we are, and because we are free, and because Americans can run their own business, then perhaps we should be very worried if we ever modify America to the point that they don't hate us. Thank you.
Touché. John.
Hi, John Utley again, the American Conservative Magazine. What the panel has not addressed is our economic crisis, the budget deficits, etc. Although we argue, many of us, that America is hated overseas because of our government, it's certainly the government, not the American people and our government policies. But I'd like you all to address the economic issue. We would also be disliked, if you will, if we go down and people see the world, the whole world sees us as on the way down. Spending $1 trillion or wasting it, if you will, with our wars is one reason. How do we solve the budget deficits? And I would add, warfare, welfare go together. That's why we're often called a warfare, welfare state. Bush, to get reelected, felt he had to expand welfare with Medicare. So if that's, they go together, and since Bismarck they have, you can't cut one without the other. I submit that you all look at one area you have to consider is the military, etc., establishment. And that's not just the Army. It's the, for example, the intelligence agencies. The Washington Post had a report. There are 50,000 reports published every year among overlapping intelligence agencies fighting for turf. The incredible waste all through the establishment for the military, etc., security establishment. You go at both. And last point, the F-22, it's built in 42 states. That what the government does now, the military industrial, is they start manufacturing a weapon before it's been fully tested. And then they get a constituency. They have to have inputs from as many states and congressional districts as possible, which vastly drives up the price. And they start manufacturing these things, so you've got a constituency to keep making them, even if the F-35s are sitting on the runway because they don't have the proper stuff yet. Just, will you all address our financial disaster here?
Thank you. I'm not sure this panel can actually sort of solve all the problems of the world, John, but and I don't think anybody here, I doubt, maybe Grover does.
No, I got three sentences that can solve most of his problems.
Good.
Is that okay?
Let's have them.
Yeah. Look, I think, here's the cheerful news. In the past, we used to sit here as if we were holding on to the back of a car going into the lake, trying to slow it down, trying to stop the drag into socialism. With Paul Ryan's roadmap, by changing the entitlement programs, and while he doesn't write it down in draft one, he's also talking about taking Social Security and turning it into a fully funded, individually held situation like Chile, where we take people who, instead of being welfare recipients or even sometimes thinking of themselves that way in old age, and turning them into shareholders and owners of property who care deeply about how capital is treated and how savings are treated, what he does is a U-turn on the road to serfdom. He doesn't just slow down or heading down the road to serfdom. That plan is one that turns it around. It actually takes the deficit down to zero as you go into the out years because of the way it reins in entitlement spending by reforming government. I think the idea of cutting entitlements is a great way to lose an election, and reforming them to zero is a great way of winning elections. So I'm actually very confident that if we can implement the Ryan plan in each of its phases, we're in great, great shape. We just have to win a number of elections and do a lot of hard work.
John, you had a comment.
I just wanted to mention, John, I have shared your concern about the degree to which we spend money on military interventions that can be characterized as wars of choice as opposed to wars of necessity. There are differences between military interventions that address ordinary national interests versus those that have to do with the absolutely vital national security interests of the United States. And I submit that the American people do not support, and when the going gets tough, they will not continue to support a war of choice. And that has repeatedly been shown in the polls and throughout every one of these types of discretionary military interventions. The problem is that sometimes there are Pearl Harbors. And of course, well, you can debate about Roosevelt's role and so on and so forth. But sometimes there are attacks on our absolutely vital national security interests. And we need to have a defense, a strong national defense. And I don't believe that our general defense spending right now is the fundamental source of the budget problems that we have. As a percentage of GNP, it is at a relatively modest level, and we are about to be facing the rise of perhaps the first peer competitor since the War of 1812, with prospectively a larger economy than ours. China, which has between 25 and 50,000 spies in the United States, that is engaging in serial cyber attacks against the United States, that is conducting many other types of Cold War policies against the United States, and we are willfully blind towards it. And I think we need a defense establishment and an intelligence establishment. And the intelligence thing is, you know, there are, you know, military procurement is a huge problem. There is a huge testing industry that just wants to test things to death, and even though they already work, and they have big constituencies, and this is a fundamental political problem of pork barrel politics. And, you know, when we get into the war of necessity, the testing will go by the wayside.
Yes.
Next. John Purdy, the Fund for American Studies. My question is about public diplomacy and is mostly directed to John Linchowski. I've spent a goodly number of hours removing and having to re-remove what is essentially propaganda from the Wikipedia page of Ambassador Otto Reich, and it mostly stems from his time at the Office of Public Diplomacy. And my question is, how do we overcome the distinct disadvantage that we have as a relatively free country when Russia, China, Venezuela, and now Iran have their own satellite, what are essentially propaganda channels in various languages, and mostly reproduce the ideological line of a Noam Chomsky or a Hugo Chavez?
Well, what needs to be done is a structural reform in the U.S. government to do this. Right now, there is absolutely no incentive for anybody in the U.S. government to exercise excellence in public diplomacy. If you wanted to become an ambassador, relations with foreign people, influence, strategic influence, is not your ticket to an ambassadorship or an assistant secretaryship. We need to have a covert political action capability. That capability is the one thing that we could do right now that would be the best possible thing towards Iran. Iran has been engaging in all kinds of Cold War policies against the United States. It deserved to be punished much more than Saddam ever did. It has been responsible for killing probably thousands of Americans in other countries. In the wars nearby, and because of their IEDs. But what can we do there? We can do political warfare, discredit the regime. delegitimize it, create faction, exacerbate factionalism within the regime, support opposition groups. This is the hard edge of strategic influence. The Iranian people love America by and large. Even religious figures in Iran have split with the regime because of its polluting the integrity of the Shiite religion, and we're doing absolutely nothing to try to exploit this and to bring about some kind of political change. There's a difference, you know. I've written a book, if I may be shameless and advertise it, it's called Full Spectrum Diplomacy and Grand Strategy, and it is a complete blueprint for how to restructure the U.S. government in order to restore incentives and a culture of excellence in public diplomacy, as well as in the CIA, where we need it. I recommend creation of what I call the U.S. Public Diplomacy Agency. I believe that its head has to be a statutory observer on the National Security Council at the same rank as the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the director of National Intelligence. I believe that within that agency, you take all the former USIA functions, the broadcasting functions, USAID, the Peace Corps, the and put them all in one empire of relations with foreign people. And then, if you really want to fix it, this is supply side government policy, by the way. You make it so that 50% of all ambassadorships come out of the U.S. Public Diplomacy Agency. And then you will see the smart boys at the State Department change what they feel has to be done in terms of their career excellence. And I think that will solve the problem hugely.
Is there any truth to the rumor that the DIA or the Pentagon, either one, has taken a fulsome effort in trying to take this over, and if so, are they doing any good?
The Pentagon is the only place that has been conscious about doing this. And it's not been the intelligence community so much as it has been the special operations community and the people that used to be called psychological operations, which are now called military information support groups. And frankly, I agree with the euphemism, MISO, military information support operations, because there are just too many people who have delicate stomachs and need to take lots of Maalox or something when you start talking about psyops. And so let's go ahead and call it that. But they have cultural knowledge, linguistic knowledge, and a capability to have positive effects. And they're about the only game in town, but they are absolutely tiny.
Yes.
Where would we be without Baron von Steuben, who helped George Washington organize the troops in Valley Forge? You asked, John, about our soft power and lack thereof. And I wonder if we as American conservatives have compassion to be that city on a hill. I was meeting a few months ago with the head of the International Department at Leadership Institute, and he frankly told me that there wasn't any funding coming in for doing the type of outreach that organizations like Carville as displayed in the movie, our brand is Crisis, that are going to these foreign countries, are helping out with their elections, and are being those helps to the George Washingtons around the world. Are we giving back what we've been given by other nations as conservatives, projecting our message? I appreciate your comments, Grover, because I heard a gentleman when I was 14 years old. His name was David Barton. He asked, who's going to the darkest place of the earth? Who's going to the smoke-filled room of politics? And since that time, I've endeavored to do that. But there's a few organizations out there like that. I mean, International Republican Institute ends up doing most of its work with government funding, and not really party building, not really building the conservative movement, but more of what the State Department supplies. What are we doing as conservatives to project ourselves into political campaigns and build international political consultancies to project the city on a hill?
Well, you know, it was during the Reagan administration that we created the National Endowment for Democracy. The lodge and its subsidiary organizations, which included the International Republican Institute, the Democratic Party counterpart, the Center for International Private Enterprise, and the American Institute for Free Labor Development, and in order to satisfy all constituencies. The logic behind this was that we were going to fight communism not just with anti-communism, but with a positive alternative, which was representative government, rule of law, human rights, et cetera, et cetera. And many of those organizations have given grants to all sorts of good organizations that have made very positive positive contributions. Unfortunately, people are policy. And there have not been enough people who share the fundamental principles that we in this room share, who have gone into a lot of this business. During the Reagan administration, we had such people. We had people like Bob Riley, who was here, who was running the private sector programs office of the U.S. Information Agency, and he would give out grants to such as the Claremont Institute to do American founding principles types of seminars for foreigners, and it was a fantastic program. But you've got to have Bob Riley's out there in the world, in the government, to do this kind of stuff. And also helps to have philanthropic foundations pay attention to this. Mm-hmm. You know, one reason why Phil said some things about me in my founding of IWP is that the major philanthropies in this country do not fund foreign policy and national security. And insofar as they do, they fund the liberal organizations and not the conservative ones. And that's because all of the conservative foundations think the government takes care of this. And so what arguably is the highest public policy priority, which is peace and security, is neglected by so many of those philanthropic organizations. And the result is that you have a guy like Al Santoli, referred to earlier, who gets no salary. He lives off his military pension, and he does all of this work in the southern Philippines, and he gets donations of medicine from American pharmaceutical companies for pennies on the dollar, and uses local staff. It's unbelievable what one guy can do, and imagine if somebody were to help him.
Indeed.
People are policy.
Just a quick note. I'm trying to see if Alex Chafwin is still here, but not to sort of overdo it, because Atlas is A, not the solution to all problems, and B, it's not that huge. But it's significant that through the Atlas Network we have a significant conservative outreach to seed think tanks to foster free market ideas as around the world. I mean, so don't completely short shrift what we've done here as conservatives, given what we have to work with.
Yeah,
yes,
thank
sir.
You. No, 1 second. I want to stress what Atlas has done, because I think that the number of competent center-right free market think tanks around the world is an incredibly helpful asset. The Heritage Foundation does resource banks in Africa and Europe, and where they bring them all together to do more training as well. I run a taxpayer group, and one of the projects we're doing is working with creating competent taxpayer groups in other countries. And if you've got a taxpayer group and a think tank, you've got the beginning of a coalition that can start to work with parties from a principled basis. The great thing about taxpayer groups is there's no such thing as a left-wing taxpayer group. But you put that together with a serious free market think tank, and you've got the nucleus of a community, and those think tanks are tremendous assets. And I know at least 62 really good ones, and I'm sure there are others that we haven't worked with.
Yes. Thank you very much.
Yes, sir.
My name is Bill Bonner. I'm an attorney.
and I've greatly appreciated the opportunity to hear the wisdom that's been shared here. I want to speak, however, in favor of more emphasis on the law. We are a country under the rule of law, which is very different than a country under the rule of a without that basis. I believe that people don't have access to understand the law. They don't have access to study the law, and that it is a very profound part of protecting our identity and protecting our democracy. I believe that we need to have more emphasis on those programs such as at Hillsdale and other places where the law is taught to the people. Law has a very cancerous ability to metastasize through the administrative law process. And it's totally beyond the control and the accountability of the people. We have major battles that people don't even take account of, such as those in the courts right now over the right of association, the Hastings Law School case. The attack on the right of association is an attack which will broaden, and it will teach those in the university that they should not have statements of principles, whether they want to be professional accountants or Democrats or Catholics or whatever they want to be, that their organizations can't have principles which would exclude anyone who doesn't have those principles. And I believe that that's a very serious attack on our whole ability to protect our democracy. So I...
Do you have a question or just a comment?
My question to you is that I just wanted to say that I believe that there has been a lack of emphasis on the root need for study of the law, and would ask for your suggestions about how that can be accentuated in our society.
Thank you. Anyone want to?
Yeah, Leah, let me just comment quickly. In the past, American lawyers and bar associations and so on have gone abroad to help emerging countries draft new constitutions, establish a legal system. It's obviously something the private sector does much better than the government. That's probably not a government function. Just to demonstrate how pervasive the left-wing attitude is in this country, though, not long ago, one of the senior members of the Supreme Court suggested in response to that, just that question, that perhaps the American Constitution would not be the best example for a new emerging country drafting a constitution, but I think she suggested that the Constitution of South Africa might be a better one. It shows you what judges think about the Constitution, I guess.
This is also a problem that Americans have created because we use democracy as shorthand for rule of law, property rights, freedom of association. And they're not the same thing at all. I mean, democracy is a better way than a king to protect already existing rule of law, property rights, and freedom of association. It's not necessarily the best way to get from here to there. So if we were clearer about why we're successful, I mean, we go to the guys in Zimbabwe and say, if we're rich and powerful because we have elections. So if you have elections, you'll be rich and powerful. And they have elections and don't work. And we lied to them. So obviously we're just stealing everybody's stuff, right? Because it doesn't have anything to do with having elections. So we don't even tell people why we're successful. And then we tell them the wrong thing. You know, if you all drove red cars, it would work. You know, red cars are nice, but that's not what democracy is nice. It's a way to protect what you already have. It isn't what we're protecting. We're protecting freedom. That's why we're rich and powerful and successful and have more fun than everybody else.
Yes, sir.
Thank you. My name is Ross Stovall. My first visit here, I'm from Indianapolis and a small businessman. And thank you for this conference. It's been a real treat. Very fine panel today. I have two quick questions, if I may.
Please.
First question is, What are we doing in terms of the agenda so that we cut through the fog of the onslaught of issues that will be raised, beginning with the millionaire's tax, this week? That's the first question. And the second question is, how did that reset button work out? President Obama, when he came in office, of course, said we need to reset our relations with other nations. I'd like to hear the panel's input on how that has worked out and what are we going to be saying about that between now and November.
Okay.
Thank you.
Let's take the first question. You want to handle that, Grover?
Sure. On the first one, the millionaire's tax. This is a so-called Buffett rule that you should have a 30% minimum tax rate for anyone who earns $1 million. That would raise somewhere between $30 and $40 billion over the next 10 years. Okay. Over 10 years, $30 and $40 billion. Obama, with his baked-in tax increases, has a deficit debt, additional debt spending of between $6 and $7 trillion over the next 10 years. So the key thing to say is, well, Obama's planning on spending $7 trillion more than is coming in. A piece of that would be the billionaire's tax, which means the middle class will be paying just shy of $7 trillion. The president has just told you what he's going to do to middle-income Americans because he told you what he's going to do to rich people, and it doesn't get us to half of 1% of the problem. Therefore, he's told you who he's targeting, and we know that Democrats, liberals practice trickle-down taxation. You promise to tackle the rich, and you get everybody. The alternative minimum tax was targeting 115 people in 1969. January of next year hits 31 million people. He promised he'd never raise taxes on anyone who earned less than $250,000 a year. 16 days into his presidency, Barack Obama signed his first tax increase, a tax increase on cigarette smokers, average income $40,000 a year, and we know from scientific study only one American who earns more than $250,000 a year smokes cigarettes, and his name is Barack Obama. So they always say they'll tax the rich, and they always screw you, and we've got history on our side, and the good news is all the polling data shows 75% of the American people know that all conversations about taxing them mean they'll get me.
Let me just respond quickly to one other thing, which is a little bit off point, but I think still goes to the point, and that is the narrative, the message that we use. Actually, the millionaire's tax is a very clever political narrative. People don't know what it means, and they think, yeah, those people should pay their fair share, whatever that is. Liberals have a much better way of conveying those things than we do, frankly. What we are likely to do is, with the millionaire's tax gets put up by the liberals, and we will have charts and graphs and numbers, and people's eyes glaze over, and they have no idea what we're talking about. The liberals will always use one person like Warren Buffett's secretary, and who will resonate across the country, and everybody will remember that she pays more taxes or a higher rate than Warren Buffett does. And Grover, I think you're pretty good at that, but too many of our people counter that with saying, well, there are 8 million people that pay X number of dollars and so on. Nobody has any idea what they mean, and they win the argument. So that's, I think, something that conservatives need to work on continually, is figuring out how Ronald Reagan used to do it. Remember the welfare queen? Everybody remember the welfare queen, and he didn't have to talk about how many people were on welfare, how much they were getting. All they remembered was this one woman. And I think it's a lesson that all of us need to remember in how to convey the message and the narrative that is so – we have such a good message, but we convey it so badly that we have to correct that.
Mike?
Yes, just for really brief comments on what he wants to do is change the capital gains rate to the normal income tax rate for certain people. Number one, most of that money has already been taxed. In other words, you get taxed at the normal rate, and then you invest it, and he wants to tax it again. I think we need – as have our leaders talk about it that way. Number two, this would really harm the venture capital industry that takes a lot of risk in this country to start companies. $25 million were invested with Bob Noyce and Gordon Moore and started Intel in 1968, just $25 million. But just think of that venture capital said, you know, one-third of this income is going to get taxed rather than 15% or whatever. I wonder if people will do it today. The third thing is capital is a coward, and so every time the president attacks people that have capital, it does something else rather than invest. And then finally, over half the American people own stock today. And so he's taking on half the American people, and we need to have our leaders talk about that. Just ask an audience, Mr. Romney, raise your hand if you own stock. He's coming to get you. He wants to raise your taxes on whatever you make in this wonderful stock market the last 3 years. If you've made anything at all, he's going to double the taxation of that. We need to talk about it in those terms.
You mentioned the reset button, hitting the reset button. To clarify, President Obama specifically said he wanted to hit the reset button on relations with Russia. That's an area of John's expertise, and I know he's going to want to talk about that, but not before I do. Obama set about, announced that he wanted to improve relations with Russia that had soured. Democrats like to have good relations with Russia for some reason. Anyway, what's never been really discussed is that why were those relations soured under particularly the W administration? Richard Pipes has left us, so we can't really talk about his book, you know, Russia Under the Old Regime, but I think that we could look back into Tsarist Russia and see a lot of parallels to Russian foreign policy today. In the 19th century, Russia's foreign policy, particularly in the subcontinent, was largely a spoiler foreign policy to operate against the interests of the British Empire, the largest empire in the world at the time, figuring that what was bad for number one was bound to be good for number five or number four or wherever they were in the ranking of world powers at that time. They were, in other words, troublesome and uncooperative in a lot of things, not in all things. Tsar Nicholas II won the Nobel Peace Prize for proposing a world court. But in many ways, they were spoilers in the international system. And that's a role that Russia has continued to play, I'd argue, in the post-Cold War world when it's come to cooperation with us on what we see as major international challenges. And you may disagree about it, but the Bush administration certainly thought that the war in Afghanistan and the war of choice in Iraq were for them major international challenges about which Russia was nothing but unhelpful. So the Obama administration's arrived trying to propitiate the Russians and put things on a better footing. And how's it done that? Well, it's canceled a missile defense program for Europe that the Russians objected to on specious grounds that deliberately misrepresented the known capabilities of the actual radar that we were going to emplace in the Czech Republic and Poland. Why do they object to that? Well, the claim is that the defense system will really operate against them. But the reality is that it will bind their former clients, whom I think they're never really given up returning to client status, more closely to the West and away from them. The Obama administration revived traditional arms control, which had largely been put to death by the W administration with the Moscow Arms Control Treaty, where we basically said, we don't have to negotiate any more of these anymore. We are basically trusting each other. You have your strategic needs. We have our strategic needs. We're going to sort of work to a range of deployed nuclear warheads, something we practically can't actually verify. We sort of have to take each other's trust. But operating in this range for you and this range for us, pick the number you want. You'll be comfortable with it, and we're out of this bilateral negotiating business. What that did was also take the Russians out of our politics, because no longer would it be a measure of whether you had a successful presidency or not, whether you had concluded an arms control agreement with Russia. That used to be, in the Cold War years, a sort of a yardstick of whether you were a good American president or not, whether you were politically correct, you might say. Obama's revived bilateral arms control on nuclear weapons with Russia, and in the same bean-counting way that we used to do it in the Cold War, but, of course, with less verification, because, of course, Russians find verification inconvenient. I'm tempted to say, and for what? The nuclear security equation now is no longer a bipolar or bilateral equation between the U.S. and Russia only, where all other nuclear powers, China, France, Britain, etc., can be considered lesser included cases. You know, the lid has practically been blown off the non-proliferation regime, and we are facing a proliferated world in which the logic of deterrence elaborately worked out in the 20th century for a bilateral standoff with Russia may simply not apply. We haven't done any of the research to determine whether it would apply. I've written a little bit about that. So what's the reset all about? I mean, I'm sure from Russia's standpoint, it's gone fabulously well. I mean, Obama's consulting with Medvedev about messages that he wants to be sure get through to Vladimir. And I hope you're all reassured by that, that they have such a lively conversation. But what's the reset been all about? It's been largely about partly reviving the past, a Cold War past that, to my way of thinking, ought to be dead and buried, and about propitiating a country that's been off sides with us for reasons that have nothing to do with the propitiation that we're offering. So I think it's, frankly, a net loss for the U.S., but then I'm just an old Cold Warrior.
Thank you.
How about you?
I just want to say amen to that. I think it's marvelous what Philip just said.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Well, that being the case, I burnt up all of our time with that last answer. Are there any more questions? Otherwise, we can let you out 2 minutes early. Yes. Paul.
Not so much a question, but just to follow up what John said. And John, Paul Bonicelli, we haven't seen each other in a long time. Your fine points. Although I would say the Bush administration had at least two good people, myself and my colleague Jackie Schaefer, who put every dime at USAID we could toward these ideas and these values. And it can be done. In fact, the bureaucracy had, what was it, three Adam Smith ties among the civil servants that we elevated, and it resonates in these countries.